Group meeting, Sunday, 13th January, 1991. There were two special topics we touched upon. Do you remember what they were? One of them was mentioned a few minutes ago.
Also, that living the religious life is not different from living... It's not something that's different from living one's own life in the world. That one can live the religious life while still living in the world. And that's when you touched upon the various gifts that we have.
Well, it was put in a slightly different form, if you remember.
The uniqueness of each individual person.
Yes.
Was the keynote you started from, wasn't it?
The
uniqueness of each
yes.
individual person.
Yes. Each person has some sort of natural ability or interest, and it is necessary for that person to cultivate that ability or interest and express it in his daily life, personally and socially. That was one topic we touched upon. And the other topic, of course, was happiness. How many of you recollect we touched upon happiness? Because happiness is something which starts right from the beginning of our lives. Every creature that is born wants to be happy, fulfilled. Of course, the idea of fulfillment and fruition comes much later, but it starts as happiness. And happiness in the ordinary way through all the sense functions. Sensuous happiness. And you may recall I mentioned what the Buddha taught about this matter. He first starts with the happiness of the senses. Sight by the eyes, touch, hearing, smell, taste, and so on. And then he goes on to point out that if anyone says that this is the greatest happiness anyone can have, he would disagree, because there is happiness which, in his own words, is more excellent than sense happiness. And he talks first first of sense happiness, and then goes on to say that when a person sits down and thinks, concentrates his attention upon some worthwhile topic, he experiences a happiness which is much greater than that of the senses. And this procedure has several stages, actually about 9 in all. The first 4, which are called the jhanas or dhyanas, the paying attentions. That is what dhyana means, paying attention. And he says that this is the happiness which is greater than sense happinesses. And then he goes on to say that there is a second stage where thought stops. The thinking process comes to an end. And with the ending of the thinking process, he enters the second stage, which is a profounder happiness than the first. And so he goes on to the third and the fourth stages, declaring that each one of these stages is more happy, deeply happy than the previous stage. Then he comes to what are commonly called the Sammāpattis. The jhanas, the four jhanas, are followed by four Sammāpattis. Now, Sammāpatti has been, I think, not happily translated as attainments. In a sense, we may regard them as attainments, just because I can't do that, but John Smith can do it. Therefore, I can say that he has attained that stage, whereas I haven't. The real meaning of Sammāpatti is a coalescence. Now, note very carefully this statement about being a coalescence. I think it is D.N. Dwivedi, a very profound scholar, who pointed that out when he wrote about these things in his book on yoga. It is a coalescence between one's own state of consciousness and the consciousness which emerges transcendentally as compared with the first or the second or the third or the fourth. And these four Sammāpattis are transcendental counterparts of the four jhanas. Now, actually, I feel that meditation in the profoundest sense really begins with the Sammāpattis, because the idea of the infinity and eternity of those modes of consciousness is emphasized. And therefore, the Sammāpattis are transcendental as contrasted with the jhanas. And then he finally ends up with a statement of the complete cessation of consciousness in any particular mode, whether it be a mortal mode or even an immortal mode. I like to think of the Sammāpattis as the beginning of pure meditation in the true sense, because the context being the context of eternity and infinity, we are touching upon that which is altogether transcendent. And this can be realized by you yourself whilst you are bodily alive in this world. If, that is, you care for it, are interested in it, and discipline your daily life in the necessary way, which releases this kind of transcendental consciousness. And he calls it the cessation, the complete cessation. Now, this means that all the limitations which are inherent in any state of consciousness which is associated with any sort of manifestation has come to an end. So there is what the Mahayanists call the supreme emptiness, the shunyata. Shunya means empty. And emptiness is surrounded by that which is manifest. Take a cave, for example. The cave itself is empty. But surrounding that emptiness is the structure which makes it a cave. This is the Buddhist teachings have considered this as the final possibility for any human being. That which the Christian mystics have called the Unio Mystica. And the purpose of human existence is implicit in that sort of teaching. For this reason, what we observe in the entire evolutionary process is a step-by-step development of consciousness. First we get it in the plant kingdom, just the first traces of consciousness, of sensitivity, which is a conscious sensitivity. You know, there are certain kinds of ferns, for instance. If you move your hand towards those ferns, they close up just by themselves. You see, and if you move your hand back away, they reopen. So there is a peculiar sort of beginning of consciousness, of sensitivity there. And that becomes more developed in the insect kingdom, and from the insect kingdom into the animal kingdom. And in the animal kingdom, and this is what so many people in the world, when it was first stated, disliked very much. Charles Darwin was very much depreciated for saying it, that we are descended from monkeys. But that is literally true, physically. Particularly the primate group amongst the Catarrhini. There are the Platyrrhini and the Catarrhini. The Platyrrhini peoples the New World, the Americas, and they didn't develop particularly far. But the Catarrhini, who peopled, I say peopled, but I should say who monkeyed, flourished in the Old World, Africa and Asia, the Catarrhini developed a particular type of species which ultimately became Homo sapiens. Of course, sapiens was the term applied by living scientists of our own century. What happened apparently was something like this, that as the forests in the world dwindled and the grasslands grew, these monkeys began to stand upright and run, and also discovered ways and means of obtaining their food from plants. For example, a chimpanzee can take a crooked stick and pluck a fruit with it for himself. And if that stick is not long enough, without any instruction from human beings, he knows how to tie together two sticks and make it long enough to reach that fruit and pluck it for himself. So it is from the Katharini of the old world that the human form has ultimately evolved. And the development of the brain took place more and more rapidly as Homo sapiens developed physically. And his power of speech because changes took place in the throat, in the eyes, he got stereotyped vision and various other changes which enabled him to develop the power of speech to such an extent that he could communicate with his fellow human being. Now, the point I wish to emphasize is this. How does the Buddha finish this particular discourse on happiness, starting from sense pleasure and going through all the states of happiness which come with the different jhanas and the transcendental states of transcendental consciousness. He finishes by saying, he didn't say that. He finishes by saying, those belonging to other sects who speak thus, then should be spoken to as follows. Your reverences, the Lord does not lay down that it is only pleasant feeling that belongs to happiness. For your reverences, the Tathagata, that is the Buddha, lays down that whatever, wherever, whenever happiness is found, it belongs to happiness. So that obviously, the Buddha includes sense pleasure in the category of happiness as such. Now, curiously enough, the monastic orders of the world have tended to decry all sense happiness and call it a hindrance to spiritual progress. This is not true. All sense happiness is happiness as much as any form of psychical or spiritual happiness. It is man who must learn to take it in his stride and not be the slave of the desire to repeat any particular kind of sense happiness. This is where the trouble comes and the difficulty comes. It is the longing for repetition that causes the trouble. Otherwise, every sense happiness is a pure happiness. And those of you who are happily married know exactly how true that is. Now, there's another aspect to these things. Sense happiness has this drawback. It is associated with excitement, with a state of unbalance. It is ecstatic. You may remember I mentioned this in December. It is ecstatic. Now, ecstasy means being beside yourself, not in command of yourself. Whereas the happiness which is born of the development of the mind and the purification of the psyche, I should say of the whole psychophysical organism as such, is something which is enstatic. That happiness is that which emerges as you go inwards. You all know how the Buddha said, "Look within, thou art Buddha, the enlightened one." And in the realization of being the enlightened one, each person has completely fulfilled his destiny and the purpose of his existence as a member of the human race. He is truly then Homo sapiens. But up till now, there have been very few who are real representatives, who have been and are living today, who are truly Homo sapiens. Most of them are somewhat more inclined to be stultus and criminalis rather than sapiens. Sapiens is so all too often mixed up with common sense. The common sense which enables you to triumph over your neighbor. Competition. And competition in its worst forms is, of course, war, which is very likely at present, as far as we know. And yet, it is possible that a miracle might take place and prevent war. But war takes place constantly within our own individual selves. We are fighting this, that, or the other within ourselves. And as long as each one of us is not at peace, then how can we expect world peace? Because the world is the result, the expression of what we human beings ourselves are. This is something that is never properly understood or taught in schools or in the home or in many other places. The world state is the result of our state. We are subject to emotions and thoughts which are in turmoil, and that turmoil expresses itself inevitably in course of time outwardly. Its final expression is in terms of war. The qualities like greed, hate, fear, suspicion, and so on, delusion, ambition, all these things, they make for a state of war. And only insofar as we can free ourselves from all that, can the world be free of war. You know how Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be known as the children of God." The child of God must necessarily mean the child of the absolute good. And if God is to be regarded as good, and we are to be regarded as the children of God, then we have to be good in the godly sense. This, of course, is where the whole question of individual choice and judgment comes in. Because, as we all know from personal experience, right from our very young days, the good which we have to do, which is an imposed good, is something which we fight against, we rebel against it. And we say, "Oh no, let's have a good time. Eat, drink and be merry, tomorrow we die. Well, let's hope somebody dies tomorrow. I know, you know whom I'm referring to." But that won't solve the situation, because there are so many others like him. We have to discover the good in ourselves. And part of that good is expressed in our own natural ability or interest. If you are interested in music, for instance, or interested in the arts, in the sciences, philosophy, all these things are pointers to the possible good which lies dormant within us. And it becomes our business to cultivate it, to see it in the first instance, cultivate it and draw it out and express it. And that way, each one of us can make a proper contribution to the good of the world as such. Otherwise, mere philosophies take us nowhere. Innumerable philosophies have come into being in the world's history, and most of them have been just cast aside ultimately. Only the few survive. And the few which survive are those which have transcended all the difficulties and limitations and sorrows which arise out of greed and hate and delusion, fear, suspicion, and so on. It isn't an easy task. Have you ever tried to write a Bach prelude and fugue or a Beethoven symphony or a Wagner opera and see how difficult it is? Or a Michelangelo's painting. You see, the good things are difficult. But that difficulty is something which we have to deal with, tackle it. And deal with it in the right way. Not in the spirit of conquering the difficulty. I think it has been one of the theological and philosophical mistakes made in the world when people have said we must fight against the evil, overcome evil. What you fight against all too often strengthens the enemy. Edward Carpenter, who was a very interesting writer in the early part of the century, he has written very nicely about this matter. That which you fight against becomes stronger and stronger through your fighting, because it calls out, it rouses up opposing strengths. If you call out opposing strengths, then you are harming yourself as well as those around you. But if you can call out friendliness, compassion, taking delight in the happiness and joy of others, and having that kind of transcendent dispassionateness, which is love at its highest point, then you are doing something which is truly human. You know, we learn things, as we say, by studying them, by perceiving them. And we also know the difference. Not all of us know the difference between knowing intellectually with the brain only, and there is, on the other hand, knowing with the heart. Now, what is the meaning of knowing with the heart? If you perceive something with unconditional love, then you come to know that which you are observing with the heart. You see, the Sanskrit word is hridaya, hridaya. And hridaya has been, of course, it refers to the physical heart also. It also has this meaning, as when we say the heart of the matter is so and so, the essence of it. So one learns with the heart when one observes with unconditional love. There is no expectation involved in it. There is no personal gain or fear of loss involved in it. It is dispassionate in the pure and the true sense. The Pali word is upekha. I like to translate it as dispassionate love, and it is the culminating point of the development of love within oneself. It is undemanding, it is unpossessive, it expects nothing, it looks for nothing. It just is there. And that is something which emanates only from those who have, at least in some measure or other, realized, that is, made real their humanity. And I have mentioned, you all know I have mentioned this so often in the talks, the word human really means happy creator. We associate the idea of creator with a personal God. But the thing is that each human being has within himself all the possibility of godliness. Pythagoras, in his Golden Verses, ends up, I think, with the statement that when you have transcended all the limitations which you see in your own self, you will be an immortal God. And the religions of the world have presented God in their own special way. Much of it, I'm afraid, is rather a poor way. It is not so much a case of man as the representative of God, but God as the representative of man. If God is to be a jealous God, then he is somewhat human in the poor sense of the word, not in the right sense. But I think that the translation jealous is a mistranslation. It should be zealous. Our God is a zealous God. He cares. He is concerned for your welfare and your fruition. If each one of us is the child of God, then we have to be godlike in that sense. So now, this idea of cultivating and expressing our natural interests and abilities. In that lies a happiness which can be a true happiness, because it belongs to the person who is considerably free from all selfness. It just happens that way with him. He is unselfish naturally. He hasn't got to struggle to be unselfish. He's naturally giving and loving.